Okay, good evening, everybody. Normally, I would start by thanking you all for coming, but because of the mandated curfew, where else are you going to be? So, we're all happy to be here together. So, previous weeks, we spoke about the idea of tefillah as a relationship. And I want to ask you to take a second just to think about. Think back to any relationship you have. Perhaps there's someone who only speaks to you when they need something. Maybe when things are okay and you want to chit-chat, they're not interested. But when they need a favor, they're always quick to call. So think for a second about if you are that kind of person or if you have dealt with someone like that. It's probably very frustrating. It's probably very annoying to have someone who only reaches out when they need something. Now, in a way, one could ask the question of, when we dive into Hashem, aren't we also guilty of that to some extent? We spoke last week about davening for other people. And I mentioned at the end that the truth is most of us tend to daven for other people, even for ourselves, when there's something wrong. When someone is struggling with shidduchim or infertility, parnasa, health, that's the time people usually turn to Hashem and daven. Is that a chutzpah in a way? Is that maybe insulting to Hashem? That we, when things are fine, when things are going great, we don't look up, we don't make a mention. But then suddenly when things become difficult and challenging, we look up and we say to Hashem, what's happening over here? You gotta help me. So today I'd like to discuss that idea of davening when things are difficult. The idea of davening, what's called be'es tzara. In a crisis, davening at a time when things are not going so well. And what we're going to see is that davening be'es tzara, davening when things are not going well, not only is it not a chutzpah, it's actually perhaps the best, most appropriate type of tefillah, the most effective tefillah that we can do. I mentioned before the idea of tefillah be'es tzara. That comes up in a very important context. There is a discussion about what exactly are the taryag mitzvos, what exactly is counted as a mitzvah min haTorah, and which mitzvos are only derabbanan. Now we do mitzvos deraisa and derabbanan, we keep all the mitzvos, but it's important to know conceptually what is the strength, what is the power behind each mitzvah, and perhaps mitzvos that are min haTorah, mitzvos that come from the Torah itself, might have more strength. An important question to ask is tefillah, is davening a mitzvah min haTorah? The idea of davening a formal tefillah every single day, is that a mitzvah min haTorah, or is it not? Well, in source number one, the Rambam actually counts tefillah as a formal mitzvah in the Torah, just like shofar and tefillin and eating matzah. The Rambam writes, mitzvah number 5 out of the 613, a person has to daven every single day. The Ramban, also one of the Rishonim, who was born about 50 or so years after the Rambam, he disagrees. He doesn't think that tefillah is a formal mitzvah. He doesn't think tefillah is unimportant, but he doesn't think that tefillah should be counted as one of the formal mitzvahs, as say, from the Torah. However, the Ramban, in source number 2, ends off that he thinks there is one type of tefillah that he agrees to the Rambam might be min haTorah, might have that extra special strength that is from the Torah itself. And he says, when a person davens be'es tzara, when a person davens because things are difficult, because times are going rough, that tefillah may take on a status of a mitzvah from the Torah. So it sounds like not only is davening when you need something okay, it's not a chutzpah, but it's actually the only case where everybody agrees that the mitzvah is actually min haTorah. So what would that be? How could that be? If the Ramban doesn't agree that davening in general is a biblical mitzvah, so then when it's an eis tzara, what is that mitzvah? If davening by itself is not a mitzvah, so then when things get rough and then you daven, so what mitzvah are you fulfilling? So in source number 3, for Moshe Feinstein, he explains that actually tefillah is part of a larger mitzvah, the mitzvah of believing in Hashem. Emunah b'Hashem, having trust, having faith that Hashem exists. Because if you think about it, what does it mean Hashem exists? There's no body, there's no statue, there's no picture, there's nothing for us to say, look, it exists because it's in my living room. So in what sense does Hashem exist? He exists in the sense that you relate to him. He exists in the sense that when he's there for you, you acknowledge he's there. If a person, God forbid, had a fire in their house, and they never used the fire extinguisher, and they had a fire again and again and again, so what good is the fire extinguisher? If you don't acknowledge that it exists, if you don't use it when you need it, so in what sense is it there? So when it comes to Hashem, our belief in Hashem, in what sense is Hashem really there if when we need him, we don't call out to him? When we're in a crisis, when there is that fire, if we're not going to go ahead and use him, if we're not going to go ahead and reach out to him, so then that's a lack in believing either that he knows, or that he cares, or that he can do something about it. And very interesting, at the end of source number 3, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that because of that, he thinks that the mitzvah of davening would apply to both Jewish and non-Jewish people. Now, non-Jewish people are obligated to only 7 mitzvahs, and tefillah doesn't seem to be one of those mitzvahs, but believing in Hashem is. And since davening be'ez tzara, davening, calling out to Hashem during a crisis, is a part and parcel, the best way to show that Hashem is real, He's real to us. When we need Him, we call out to Him. We're not shy, we're not going to pretend He's not there. So it could be all humanity, all people who are obligated to believe in Hashem, which is all of humanity, everybody is obligated to daven when they need something. So it turns out that not only is it not a chutzpah to reach out to Hashem when we need Him, it's actually a formal mitzvah according to everybody. But we have to answer the question, why is that so? Why is it not a chutzpah? Why is it different than a person who never calls their mother? Not her birthday, not Mother's Day, but then when they need money, when they need something, they reach out. That's a chutzpah. So why is reaching out to Hashem this great, amazing mitzvah according to everybody? Why? Why is it not a chutzpah? So I'll share with you a story that I once heard that was really powerful. It's a great mashal that I think really perfectly explains this idea. The story is about a handyman who was working on the roof of a very tall building. So he didn't have his cell phone with him. He went up to do some work on the gutters. And while he's up there, the stone that he used to keep the door open, the wind knocked it loose, and suddenly he found himself locked up on the roof with no cell phone and no way to get down. Okay, he figures someone will probably come at some point to check up on him. He waits a couple hours and nothing doing. No one's looking for him. Okay, so what's he going to do? He goes to the edge of the building and he starts to look down. He starts to see, it's very many stories down to the ground, but maybe one of the people down there will notice him. He starts to scream out, "Hey! Hey! Hey, I need help getting down! Hello? Anybody there for me?" And people are just oblivious, just walking right by. No one's looking up. And he's getting more desperate. He starts to yell out, "Hello? Hello? Can anybody hear me? I need to come down. Can someone let me down, please?" No one's listening. So after a few hours of banging and screaming and yelling for their attention and not getting it, he decides, okay, I gotta find some other way to get their attention. So he's a handyman. He gets paid in cash, a lot of tips. So he reaches into his wallet and he starts to pull out $1 bills and he starts to throw them down. And the dollar bills gently fall to the ground. And as people just find dollar bills falling onto their head, falling onto the floor around them, they're quick to bend down and pick up the dollars to snatch them out of the air, and they keep walking. And he's shocked. No one's even looking to see where it came from. Everyone's just taking the money and running. Well, $1 maybe are only $1 bills. So he starts taking out 20s and $100 bills, and he's throwing them down. And the people are just grabbing more ferociously. They're just more eager to take the money. But still, no one's looking up. No one's curious to see where the money is coming from. And he's so frustrated. So he looks around. What else does he have with him on the roof? And he notices some little pebbles. He takes the pebbles and he starts throwing the pebbles down to get their attention. And now people are a little bit inconvenienced, but they avoid the little pieces falling down and they keep on walking. Still, no one's looking up. Finally, after a complete desperation, he takes some larger rocks and he starts to throw those down. Pretty dangerous. And now people start looking up and they say, "Hey, who is that guy? What are you doing? What are you throwing rocks for?" And he says, "Oh, I'm happy I finally got your attention. You know, I've been trying for quite a while. I even tried giving you money. You just took my money and kept walking away. I'm happy you finally looked up to notice me." And in that way, Hashem, kiviyachol, is up on high. Hashem is looking down. Hashem wants to come down. Hashem wants to be accessible, to have a relationship with us. He wants to be involved in our lives. He wants us to notice Him. And all day and all night, He's screaming and He's banging and He's yelling at us, "Hello, look at my nature. Look what I created. Look how good your lives are. Life is fantastic." We keep on walking. Life is so busy. We just keep walking. We don't look to see all that is screaming out to us in nature. Hashem decides to get a little more desperate, if it could be. Hashem starts to rain down some money and says, "Okay, if you're not going to notice me with the simple nature, my simple calling, I'll start to give you things. And certainly you'll look up to see where it's coming from." What do? We grab the good things in our life. We grab the bracha, the children, the health, parnasa. We grab the good things in our life. We keep on walking. Hashem says, "I guess it's not enough money." He rains down more bracha, more good things, fantastic things, amazing things, meaningful jobs, good relationships, amazing health, good strength. Everything is perfect. And what do? We just keep taking, we keep on running. So Hashem says, "How am I going to get this relationship? I need to come down into that world. I need to have a relationship with them." He starts throwing little pebbles, little inconveniences in life. And what do? We kind of avoid them, just let it wash over us. So every so often Hashem is pushed to the point to have this relationship with us, to get our attention. He throws down some bigger rocks. And all of a sudden we look up and we say, Hashem, what are you doing? What are you doing up there? What are you throwing down rocks for? What are you hurting me for? What are you doing? Hashem says, oh, I'm happy I finally got your attention. I've been trying for quite a while, you know. But that's what it took. That's what it takes sometimes. That's what it takes for Hashem to be felt in this world, for us to realize he's up there, he's stuck up there, if it could be, and he's waiting to come down. We asked, is it a chutzpah to turn to Hashem when things are rough and we need him? No, because that's exactly why Hashem is sending us those troubles to begin with. He's hoping we look up. He's hoping we stop during our busy days and look up and say, where is this coming from? Why is someone throwing rocks? What is he trying to get my attention to notice? If anything, if we don't look up at Eis Tzara, if we don't look up during a crisis, then we're missing the message. We're missing the whole point. We're continuing to ignore him, perhaps creating the need for even bigger rocks. It's not the same thing as a child who ignores their parent and only reaches out when there's some kind of outside need. You know what it's like? It's like that story about a family, a mother in her 40s, who one day gets a call from her elderly father who lives in Florida. And he says, Rachela, I have to tell you the sad news that your mother and I, we're getting a divorce. She says, what? What are you talking? We've been married for 50 years. And he says, yeah, well, you know, it's been a long time. We married off the kids, and we realize that we don't really have much in common anymore, and we're thinking of getting a divorce, and we've already contacted a lawyer. And she says, what? When did you think about doing this? He said, just over the last few months, we've been thinking, and we think it's the right thing to do. And the daughter is freaked out. She says, what do you mean? Who else have you told? Have you told my brother? And he says, no, you're the first person I'm telling. She says, stop. Don't make any more decisions, okay? I'm going to call Avi. We're going to come down, all of us, with our families. We're going to come down to Florida. We'll spend Pesach together in Miami. And then we'll talk about it. We'll see how it's going, okay? And then we'll make decisions from there. Don't make any decisions until we get there. Promise me you're not going to decide until we get there. And the father says, okay, I promise. I'm not going to decide until you get there. And they hang up. And the father turns to his wife and he says, honey, it worked. She and the kids are all coming for Pesach. And her brother, too. They're all coming. All the grandkids are going to come for Pesach. Now we got to work out a plan to get them to come for Sukkot. So in that case, is there something wrong that the child is only coming over, only coming to visit because there's a crisis going on? No, the parent manufactured the crisis just to get their attention. If that's the case, to hear the calling, when the parent calls and says, it's urgent, call me back, and you return the message, that's not, you're only calling when you need something. No, if what you need is to hear the message, and I want your attention, so then returning the message is the best way to react. When Hashem rains down rocks, when Hashem gives us a difficult time, it's only because, as we see in source number 4, he wants us to daven. Hashem desires our tefillos. Hashem wants us to have a relationship with him, to bring him down into the world by davening and acknowledging he exists, acknowledging we need him. But every so often, we get so caught up in the good things he gives us, we don't notice. This idea is expressed so beautifully in source number 5. Rabbeinu Bachaye is one of the Rishonim, lived in the 1300s, and he has a beautiful commentary on Chumash, where he quotes a lot of Midrashim, a lot of original ideas. And he's discussing the story that happens in Parshas B'Shalach, and Bnei Yisrael are trapped. They're in an Eis Tzara. They find themselves running away as slaves, trapped by the Yamsuf on one side, and the Egyptians coming ever closer on the other side. And the Pasuk says, Uparo hikriv, and Paro came close, and Paro was coming closer and closer, and the people dive into Hashem. That phrase, Paro hikriv, grammatically doesn't make any sense, because the word hikriv does not mean to come close. That would be Paro karav, Paro came close. Hikriv, for those who know dikduk, means to cause something else to come close. So what does that mean? Paro caused something else to come close? What did Paro cause to come close, and come close to whom? So many different pshatim are given, but in source number 5, Rabbeinu Bachaye explains, when Paro came close, when Paro came charging with that spear on that chariot, he brought Bnei Yisrael close to Hashem. That danger, that tzara, that great pressure, that great crisis he was creating by coming full speed ahead, Paro hikriv, Paro caused the Jewish people to come close to Hashem, as the psukim say exactly. They looked up with their eyes to Hashem, it worked. Hashem sent Paro just for that reason, so they can call out to him. And they called out to him. And ultimately, they were zochet to Kriyas Yamsuf, perhaps the greatest miracle of all time. This idea, he continues to explain, is really behind all the tzaros we face. It's the idea behind Hanukkah, behind Purim, source number 6 and source number 7. That's how Chazal described the threat in the Purim story. If Bnei Yisrael aren't doing tshuva, if we're not relating to Hashem well, you know what he does? He sends down a Haman. He throws down rocks, really big rocks, really heavy, very scary threats. And if nothing else, that gets us to gather together. to fast, to do tshuva, to notice him, to daven, to reach out and notice like we hadn't noticed before. We're actually in great need. We're not able to do it ourselves. We have to look to Hashem, be'ez tzara. Far from being a chutzpah, it's the greatest way to answer the calling. It's exactly what Hashem wants us to do at a time like that. It would be a mistake to ignore the message, to miss sight of the fact that Hashem is trying to grab our attention. But now I want to take it one step further. Not only is calling out to Hashem be'ez tzara, calling out to Hashem during a crisis, not a chutzpah, not only is it a mitzvah min haTorah according to everybody, it is actually the epitome of all tefillah, and perhaps the most powerful and most effective of all tefillahs. In the early 1500s, there was a Spanish conquistador, a Spanish conqueror by the name of Hernan Cortes. I'm not saying it with the correct cultural inflection, but you get the idea. Hernan Cortes was a very successful, very famous, infamous in some ways. In a lot of movies, he's the villain. He's the bad guy because he was such a successful conqueror where he just came to new countries, came to new lands, disembarked and destroyed the Aztecs in Mexico. He destroyed a lot of different countries and took over their land. Now, the legend goes that one of the things that Cortes used to do was after his people, his soldiers, disembarked from the ships, he would destroy his own ships. That's the legend. He would burn, he would destroy his own ships. And I'm sure many of his crew were thinking, this guy's nuts. These are our ships. Has he lost sight of which team is red, which team is blue? Does he not know which team we're on? But actually, Cortes had a very brilliant idea. Cortes realized that as long as his soldiers felt that they could escape, as long as they felt that retreating was an option, they weren't going to fight with all their strength. They weren't going to be all in, because if things don't go well, we're not going to double down and keep advancing forward. We're going to get out of here and come back a different day or go somewhere else. And he didn't want that. He knew for people to feel completely committed, to be all in, to be able to be most successful, you have to burn your bridges. You have to completely destroy any other option. Because as long as we have different options, we can look around and say, I'll try this for a little while. Oh, not going so well at the first sign of trouble. We back out and try something else. But when you're committed to something, when you only have one direction, there's nowhere else you can go, you can't back out of it, suddenly you find yourself with strength you didn't know you had. I'll give you another moment to think about a time, perhaps, when something had to get done. You took on more than you can chew, and you had to get it done. And somehow, all the work, it managed to be accomplished. Somehow, all the things that seemed impossible, once you had to do it, it got done. And that was Cortez's idea. Burning his own ships, forcing his soldiers to fight to the death. It was win. There was no going home. It was win or die. And ultimately, he was a very successful conquistador. So where did he get this idea from? Where did Cortez get this idea that people will fight harder if you destroy any chance for escape? So I don't know for sure if this is right, but there actually is an old ancient Jewish tradition about going to war that maybe he was drawing on. Unlikely he actually knew this, but conceptually, this idea is already found in earlier Jewish sources. In source number 8, you can see that the Rambam quotes one of the laws of going to war is that when the Jewish people go to war, the Jewish army is never allowed to completely surround the enemy. The Jewish army has to always provide at least one escape route for their enemies, which seems counterintuitive. Why should we go easy on our enemies? Some explain it's showing compassion. But no, if you look in source number 8, the Torah Tamima, who lived 100 years ago, he writes that it was actually a good strategy for our own army. Like we said, if you box in your enemy, if you force your enemy to fight to the death, you are going to give them the opportunity to find great power that maybe they don't realize they had. They're going to fight with all their koach, and you don't want to face that. By giving the enemies a way out, you allow the enemies to decide there's multiple options, and maybe they'll take those options instead of fighting us tooth and nail. Why am I telling you this? Why am I telling you all about Cortez, aside from the fact that it's really interesting? So let me take you back to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, because we're going to see that this idea that when people feel boxed in, when they feel they have no other choice, they're able to commit themselves and unleash tremendous power, is something very, very important for tefillah, specifically for tefillah be'ez tzara. At the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, which you might be familiar with, because it's Sefer Shmuel, which is a cool book of stories, but also we read this as the Haftarah on one of the days of Rosh Hashanah. So we know the story that Elkanah had two wives. He had Chana and he had Penina. And Chana was his favorite wife, but Penina had all the kids. And Chana felt inferior in that way. She felt she wasn't able to have children, and it caused her great distress. And the Pesukim describe how every year they would come to Shiloh, to the Mishkan, and they would have karbanos. They would celebrate the holidays by eating festive meals. But Chana never ate. She was so depressed. She was so bitter and broken that she couldn't have a family. She refused to eat every single year. But the Pesukim tell us the story that one year, everything changed. On that fateful day, in that fateful year, in Pasuk Ches, you can see it in source number 9, Elkanah turns to his wife Chana and he says, "Listen, Chana, don't be so depressed anymore, all right? Aren't I better to you than 10 children?" Which sounds like he's trying to be supportive and trying to be reassuring. But what does Chana do? Pesukim continued, Chana gets up and she goes off to the side. And she's completely destroyed. She is so brokenhearted. She is feeling this Eis Tzara. And what does she do? She davens. And she davens harder than she's ever davened before. She's wanted kids her entire life. But now all of a sudden she finds herself davening with such passion like she never had before. Pesukim, Yud Aleph, she pours out her heart and makes a promise to Hashem. She had never tried that before. She promised Hashem, "If you give me a child, I will devote his entire life to you." And you know what? She davened so much, she davened so well, that this time she's successful. This time, her tefillos are answered. And ultimately, a short while later, she's blessed with a baby boy who's known as Shmuel, from the book of Shmuel. What changed? Chana had been davening for a decade. And on this day, something was different. What made this tefillah different? What made this tefillah so powerful and ultimately so successful? Rav Soloveitchik, in source number 11, explains that something major had just changed in that particular year. For the first time, Elkanah, her husband, had given up on her. You can imagine for the previous 10 years that they had been davening together. They davened for each other. They went to treatments together. They held hands during all the difficult times. They cried together. And Chana felt that Elkanah was one of those avenues. He was giving her support. He was davening along with her. But what happened this year? Elkanah, like any good husband knows, sometimes you try to say the right thing, try to be supportive, and it completely backfires, explodes in your face. He tried to say to her, "Look, it doesn't matter to me, so you're not going to have kids, but that's okay, I love you anyway. I'll never stop loving you, it's going to be okay." All she heard was, "You're not going to have kids, and that's okay." And she said, "We're not going to have kids? You're giving up on me? I haven't given up on me, why are you giving up on me?" And at that moment, Chana felt so alone. For the first time, she was in this struggle alone. Until now, she had her husband by her side, and now for the first time, she finds herself be'ez tzara with no other option, no other bridge, no other avenue to turn to. All she has now is Hashem. The doctors gave up on her, her family has given up on her, she has nothing. And now she turns to Hashem, and now she davens with an unrelenting passion. She's got to have this. Hashem, you have to give it to me. I'll pledge anything you want. I'll give you anything that it takes. And you know what? That was successful. Soloveitchik explains that this idea of tefillah be'ez tzara is so powerful when we feel that there's no other option, when all of our other bridges are burnt. When any way out, any way of finding a different avenue or finding a way to backtrack is not accessible, and all you have to do is charge forward. And when that happens, we find we have koach we didn't realize we had. We have strength that we didn't realize we could unleash. And at that moment, Chana was able to tap into something so powerful, and ultimately, that was successful. And Rav Soloveitchik continues in source number 11 that it's very important that we read the story of Chana on Rosh Hashanah. Not only because in source number 10, Chana was actually answered on Rosh Hashanah, because this is the perfect attitude, he explained, for Rosh Hashanah. What better attitude to have than, "Hashem, you're the only one who can help me. You are deciding an entire year of life and death. Parnasa or not Parnasa. Marriage or not, children, grandchildren, this is everything being decided. Hashem, you are the only one." And we read the story of Chana on Rosh Hashanah to remind ourselves when we daven, we have to have this attitude, this feeling of Eis Tzara, this feeling of it's a crisis and there's no other option. I have to put all my eggs in this basket, my back is against the wall, and the only thing I can do is daven to Hashem. I'm powerless, completely powerless. I have nothing I can do. And I call this shir the power of feeling powerless. This idea, the great strength that comes out when we feel that there's no other option. We're forced to only dive into Hashem. The Torah of Soloveitchik explains the power of the Chana story on Rosh Hashanah. But I want to take it one step further. And this is probably perhaps the most important thing I want to share with you tonight. So please listen closely. It's not just Rosh Hashanah. Every day should have that urgency. And you know what? Even if we don't actually find ourselves in a moment of crisis, why should we have to wait to be in a situation where there's no hope to feel that God is our only option? The truth is, and this is spelled out beautifully in source number 13, Rabbi Rucham Lavovitz was the mashgiach of the Mir Yeshiva, passed away in the 1930s. And on Parshas Beshalach, in the story of Bnei Yisrael trapped trapped at the Yamsuf and davening because Paro Hikriv, Paro, the danger of Paro brought them to realize they only could rely on Hashem, they were trapped on all sides. Rav Yerucham Levavitz writes that that's the attitude we have to have to feel all the time. Not just on Rosh Hashanah, and not just when we actually find ourselves without any other option. Literally every single day, whether we feel life is horrible, or we feel life is amazing, or we feel life is mediocre, Hashem really is the only option. When we say Ein Od Milvado, there is no other avenue except for Hashem, it doesn't mean only when we feel that because all the doctors have told us there's no hope. Hashem really is the source of everything. And any time we have many job offers and we have wonderful marriages and wonderful homes and wonderful family and good health, that's Hashem raining down the money. He's showering down the money. But if we don't feel that he's the only avenue, if we just grab the money and run, so then we might find ourselves, unfortunately, in an Eis Tzara, where Hashem says, if you're not going to listen, if you're not going to notice, I'm the only avenue. When things are going well, unfortunately, the rocks have to come down. The paros, the hamans have to come out. The Eis Tzara has to come out to make us realize that really, the only one we have to rely on is Hashem. And that's always the case. Rav Soloveitchik explained so beautifully that when the Ramban said that I don't think tefillah is a formal mitzvah, except tefillah be'ez tzara, Rav Soloveitchik explained that at that moment, the Ramban really conceded the entire machlokas. Because what does the Rambam hold? The Rambam can hold that, yeah, all tefillah is tefillah be'ez tzara. You're right. You're right, tefillah be'ez tzara is a mitzvah. All tefillah is tefillah be'ez tzara. That's the proper attitude for all tefillahs. Even when things are going amazing, when we have the job, and we're not struggling with infertility, health, parnasa, shidduchim, when we're not fighting those battles, when we're not fighting those difficult struggles, when the rocks aren't pouring down, we're also be'ez tzara. And as long as we feel we have different bridges to go, and we have different paths, we can go to this doctor, and we have a job interview tomorrow, and we can go here, and we can go there, all those things do is just distract us from putting ourselves all in to the one avenue that actually could matter. We opened up with a question of, typically, people turn to tefillah, people have their best tefillahs. If they daven for the first time, or they daven with more kavana, typically it happens, be'ez tzara, davening for themselves, davening for others. Typically it comes out most strong and most powerful when things are going poorly. And we ask, is that a chutzpah? And the answer is no. We explain that it's not a chutzpah at all. Hashem is actually reaching out to us. He manufactures a tzara. He manufactures a danger. He manufactures a crisis for the express purpose of having us look up to notice him. It would be even greater if we wouldn't need to get that far. But either way, there's nothing wrong with that tefillah. That tefillah is the best response in a time of tzara. That's what you're supposed to do. That is the most realistic way to make Hashem real, to actually notice him when we could use him and he actually can do something for us. And so I want to leave you with one takeaway. One, I like to always try to get something very practical, something that's not just up in the air, something that's very general, to make something very real that I plan on working on for the next week in the course of tefillah, and hopefully you'll find this meaningful as well. Or maybe you have other suggestions, and that's fantastic. I mentioned a couple weeks ago, when we daven, even when we ask for things, a key part of those brachos is the idea of acknowledging Hashem is the one who gives it to us. A lot of davening is praise. Psukei de Zimra, being somech gul tefillah, mentioning Yetzias Mitzrayim before we even start Shmona Esrei. The idea of reminding ourselves Hashem is the only avenue. And not just davening itself, but even when we make brachos, when we make a bracha asher yatzar, rofecho basar mafila asos, when we say baruch atah, when we make a bracha and we say, you are the one, that should be a reminder to us, an opportunity 100 times a day to make a bracha and realize, you give food, you give health, you give parnasa. When we daven, when we make brachos, when we go wake up in the morning, go to sleep at night, we're always talking about atah. Atah, you, Baruch Atah, blessed are you. You are the one who is the Chonin Hadas. You give me wisdom. Mevarach Hashem, you give me Parnasa. You keep us safe from terrible happenings in the world. That's all on Hashem's plate. It's something that the sooner we realize it, the sooner we're tapping into the power of feeling powerless, this idea of recognizing that there are no other opportunities, there are no other sources we can turn to. Those are just Hashem's means, and we would not want him to take those away before we realize that really it all comes from him. This idea of Ein Od Milvado, this idea that there really is no one else but Hashem, perhaps by davening and having extra kavana during every time we say Atah, we notice you, we're acknowledging Hashem as the source of everything, perhaps we can tap into this idea. Even when life is great, we can tap into the idea of tefillah be'ez tzara, the idea of the power of feeling powerless, even when things are going great, and hopefully we shouldn't have to come to a situation where we find ourselves being pelted by rocks. We should be able to notice Hashem when all the good money is coming down. I just want to do a one quick plug for next week's shiur. the past three shiurim, we were explaining tefillah in a very intentional, a very focused way, where tefillah is about our relationship, noticing Hashem, really inculcating within ourselves core values. That really gives us a lot of credit. Like when we daven, we really are thinking about all those things. What exactly is the role of kavana? And more specifically, what is the role of davening without kavana? Is there any benefit to davening without kavana? Certainly hope so, because I know for myself it's very hard to daven with kavana. So hopefully please join us again next week when we talk about this topic, about how exactly to work on kavana, and more specifically how to daven without kavana.